This is a session that had not been originally on the schedule, I think for any of us, but as Ralph and Rosemary and Carol and I talked a little bit, we talked about the fact that somehow it didn't seem to be quite right to be talking about aging and all of the factors that relate to aging. Ralph has been talking about the physiological kinds of factors that relate to aging, and Rosemary and I are social workers. We've been talking about the social milieu in which we age, and Carola has been backing us up on some of these things. And then we thought that it certainly is not appropriate, if we're going to really talk about older people and aging and the changing that takes place, without taking a look at the ever-present reality of death. I think we approach this with some trepidation and certainly lack of expertise in the subject, certainly from our own personal experience of our own involvement in it. But nonetheless, we thought that today we might bring up certain things out of our own experiences and out of the reading that we may have done and the studying that we may have done, and then try to open it up for a discussion, because all of us have faced this reality, and all of us come to it with different kinds of feelings and different kinds of perceptions. I should introduce our panel, Carola, my wife, Rosemary and Ralph Bolstad, and we're going to attempt at least to share with you some thoughts and some ideas. I'd like to, could you give me that Bible, please? I'd like to open this by reading a very familiar passage of Scripture. I remember my uncle, L.W. Bow, who was president of St. Olaf College when I was a student there, and he had been president for a good many years before. He enjoyed or liked to speak at chapel, which he did quite regularly, and during my 4 years at St. Olaf, I think I heard him speak on this scripture passage at least a half a dozen times, probably a dozen if I can remember, because I can still remember what he, him up in front. But this is Psalm 90. This is a psalm of Moses, and you remember Moses lived to be a pretty ripe old age. I think he was 120 some years of age, and quite a vigorous and vital man. But this is what Moses wrote. Lord, thou hast been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hast formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. Thou turnest man to destruction, and sayest, Return, ye children of men. For 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past, and as a watch in the night. Thou carriest them away as with a flood. They are as asleep. In the morning they are like grass which groweth up. In the morning it flourisheth and groweth up. In the evening it is cut down and withereth. For we are consumed by thine anger, and by thy wrath are we troubled. Thou hast set our iniquities before thee, our secret sins in the light of thy countenance. And all our days are passed away in thy wrath, and we spend our years as a tale that is told. The days of our years are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they be 80 years, yet is their strength labor and sorrow, for it is soon cut off, and we fly away. So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom. There's a little more of it, but I think that conveys the sense that Moses had of the days of our life, and how we grow as the grass, and then wither, and then die, and He says that the days of our years are 70, and even though we live longer than that sometimes, that's 70 years, even though we live longer than that, yet, he says, our life is filled with labor and sorrow. But he ends up by saying, return, O Lord, how long, and let it repent thee concerning thy servants. Let satisfy us early with thy mercy, that we may be glad and rejoice all our days. Well, I think that we should like to share with you some personal experiences, and I'd like to start out, and then I'm going to ask Rosemary and Ralph and Carola to share a few personal experiences, whether they be of death or the length of life or of people who with whom we have talked about this subject. Carola and I, in the last about 16 months, have seen five of our good friends pass away, die. And this has been something that we really were not prepared for. Well, I guess we were prepared for it in the general knowledge that all of us are getting older and that, we've seen other people die, but suddenly this became very immediate to us within just a little over the last year to see five of our, what I would say, close friends. And, you know, people don't have that many intimate close friends, that you can lose five close friends within that short period of time without making a terrible dent in your life, and without making you reflect on your own mortality. In addition to that, we have seen a couple more, at least, of our friends begin to decline into what shall I say? Inability to be themselves anymore. Mental handicaps and so on, which have prevented them from being the kind of people they were before. Another inroad that comes upon many people in old age. And so we have been certainly forced by the circumstances in our own circle of acquaintance to really take a hard look at our own mortality and the mortality of those around us. Now, that shouldn't be strange to us, because I was a parish pastor for a number of years and then have been in social work in the church with a lot of nursing homes and everything. And I said, death is nothing new. But all at once in this last year, it became so immediate to us. And it's in that context that I come to this discussion of looking at death. Rosemary, would you like to make any comments?
Well, I guess from working in a nursing home care unit in a veterans hospital, all of the men almost were older, and death was always with us there, because this was the last stage of these people's lives. And so sometimes it really seemed like a good thing. You know, if they had been suffering, they had been sad, their families didn't really want them, they didn't visit them, and life was anything but ideal, you almost felt like, I'm happy for them, they made it, you know. They got out of this life and into the next. It seemed good. And another thing I've been aware of through the years is the change in where people are dying now. Probably 10 or 12 years ago, almost everyone died in a hospital. But now a lot of people are choosing to die at home. And if their families are willing to help them with this, they can. They can have their wish, their last wish. And my mother recently had a friend whose husband found he had cancer. He wasn't that old, maybe 70 years old. And he started with his chemotherapy, and then, well, he was just starting with that, he had a stroke. So he had those two things, and he would be in the hospital just a few days, but he definitely didn't want to be in the hospital. So she said, you know, she agreed to keep him at home. And it was really amazing what a wonderful support system there is now, and at least in large cities, for people that want to die at home. They have visiting nurses, they have therapists come. He had a speech therapist and an occupational therapist and a physical therapist, and she had nursing care around the clock, and the family were there. The daughter would come and bring her dog so that her dad could see him. And they had the bed right in the living room. And he sort of had a premonition that he was going to die. Oh, about a week before he died, he had a vision of some sort where he saw a host of people in white. And he wasn't a religious man, really. But he said, it's going to be about a week. And he was right. It was about a week. So the funeral even was nice, because some of the people that had been with him spoke and shared all the love between the family. So it was really a good experience. I wonder if any of you have had loved ones die at home. Have you?
Both my mother and sister.
Was it like that?
She had a very similar experience. Uh-huh. See, my mother was hard of hearing most of the life of my lifetime.
Uh-huh.
And we were sitting at the kitchen table, and she was on this hospital bed right in the living room.
Uh-huh.
In my sister's home. Uh-huh. And she was mumbling. We couldn't understand, because we thought perhaps she was irrational.
Uh-huh.
But all of a sudden she sat up, oh, and then fell back and stopped.
For goodness sake.
And really loud.
Right. Yeah. So you knew something was going on.
And then my sister Hazel died in that very same room some years later. And that was in 48 that my mother died, so she was at home.
Well, that was great. Mm-hmm. That was kind of unusual at that time, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And your sister?
Hazel died in the same room, because it was her home.
Uh-huh.
She died in 76. Very similar.
Did you have a lot of support?
No, just her daughter Diane and myself. Mm-hmm. But she decided she didn't want any more chemo in April. Because the doctor said, well, can't help you any much longer. So she decided, I don't want any more chemotherapy. So she went home. She was living with Diane in town there, in the cities. And she said, I've got to get out to the farm. And so my sister and her husband and the rest of us helped to open up her farm home again.
Uh-huh.
And then she was there until June 26th.
That was great.
Yeah. Are you intimating that the possibility of dying at home is a positive thing?
Yes, I think it is. You know, I think that if you think it's going to be less expensive, if you have that in mind, I don't think that's true. Because when you hire nurses around the clock and you have therapists coming in, you know, Medicare will pay for part of it, but they aren't going to pay for all of those things. So it depends upon how strong you are, how well you are, how close you are to the person. I suppose it has all sorts of ramifications, but it's something to think about for yourself and if you have older parents or those that are sick or have cancer, which is, you know, the killer of lots of young folks.
Is that not the premise of hospice? Is that not the premise of hospice?
Right.
Uh-huh. Hospice has become a...
They kind of started this whole idea.
I had the privilege of taking care of my mother-in-law for 6 weeks at home as she was dying. And it was a great experience for me. I am a nurse. So she had always said that she wanted me to take care of her when she died. And she fell and, or she had cancer and came home to our home just before Easter. And then I took care of her then for 6 weeks. Yeah. And she often said that we had our Peter was only 2 years old at that time, and he was running around. She said, oh, if I could only last a little while longer so I could help Peter talk. Our Peter was deaf, and so he didn't speak at that time. And she was, but he was around with her all during the time that she was dying, and I took care of her all during the day, and her husband, our Paul's father, took care of her at night or stayed with her. And it was just the last week that we had to have somebody come in and relieve me because it was getting a little bit long and hard to, she could not, or she was just filled with cancer and was not, but she did not take any chemotherapy of any kind or anything, but she, and we were able to keep her comfortable, I think, and she, but she did die with us when we were all, she died, Paul was, you can tell about that, you were.
I think there was something very helpful about her being at home because I was a young pastor at the time, and there was a youth convention in Hibbing, Minnesota, which was about 100 miles away. And I was supposed to go to this youth convention, and I sat down with my mother and I said, well, I think I'll stay home, because we all knew that she was, you know. And she said, no, Paul, she said, you go to the youth convention. She said, I think you should. She said, you and I have had a long chance to sit and talk while I've been here now. And she said, we've said everything we need to say to each other. And she said, if I should go before you come back, why don't feel badly about it. So I did go. I was gone 3 days. And she died about just a few hours before I got back. But I never felt badly about it. I really felt good about it because she had released me. And that was part of being able to be with her at home.
And didn't your dad kind of say the same thing to
you? Oh, yes, of course.
That was interesting.
When your dad died.
Yes, my dad did the same thing. Well, he was in the hospital. But he got my brother and me, he had had a heart attack. He was a very vigorous man. He didn't want to talk about death at all, never. And he was in his 70s, but my brother and I, he came from Illinois and I came from Iowa, and we stayed with him about a week. And of course, we were busy people, you know. One day, Dad, the doctor said he was getting better, and one day Dad got us one on each side of the bed, and he took hold of our hand, and he said, talked about his life, and he said, I've had a happy life and had good opportunities and so on. Then he said, you've been good boys, and you've really made me happy, and went on and on. And he said, now I want you to go home and go on about your work. I'm going to get just fine, and you can come back and visit me in another couple of weeks. So my brother and I decided, okay, we'd do that. So we did. And he went back to Illinois, and I went back to Iowa. Just a couple of days later, the message came that he had died. But again, we felt that he had released us and had we had had a chance to talk about death together. And I think he died because he wanted to die. He didn't want to face living without being able to live the vigorous kind of life that he... Carola, did you want to make any further comments about...
Just that, you know, everybody, it isn't all old people that die, too. We have the experience of having two little girls who have died. And they died at, well, not little girls, they were babies. They died at 3 days, both of them. And with that experience, I guess it's kind of a vague experience when our first one died, because it was a new experience for me and a new, we were in the town that we were, where Paul was pastor, so I did have people surrounding me more. But the second one was, I went down to Minneapolis from Superior and had my baby down there because I was an Rh negative and was having problems. So when I was there alone in the hospital, because Paul had gone back or was on his way back to Superior again, the baby was born and I was getting along fine, and they thought the baby was getting along fine too and didn't really realize that she was not going to make it either. So just as the morning the doctor or the nurse came in and said, well, the baby was not doing very well, and I said, well, call Paul. He's at the train station. I think you can get a hold of him. He was on his way back to Superior. And they did get a hold of him. But in the meantime, the doctor came in and said that the baby had died. And I was there alone with the doctor, and I started to cry. And he said, oh, don't cry. It's all right. It was better the baby died.
Oh.
And, you know, he didn't let me mourn or didn't let me cry. And I think I just wanted to say this because we often say this to people, oh, don't cry, you know, it was the Lord's will or something like this. We're so apt to say that. And it was a hard thing for me to be, and for a long time I couldn't cry. And I didn't cry because I wasn't supposed to cry. I hadn't thought about it when Fritz Norsted was here last week and was talking about death and dying and about his daughter dying and so forth, it all came to me, and I think it was kind of an emotional, I was really mourning now more than I had back when my baby had died. But I just think that so often we think of older people dying, but there are people that among us that have youngsters or babies that do die, and I think that if we can surround them with more understanding and love, it would help a lot.
Okay, thank you. That's grieving, of course, is a significant part of this whole matter of dying. Yeah.
I'm a nurse and I work on the OB floor, and if the baby is dying, the mother and dad go in there and hold the baby, and they can have pictures taken, and they can be there right with the baby. And
well, this
we have this compassionate friends now.
Mm-hmm. This is
and
40 years ago.
The parents can go to that class after, and we go to classes on that, you know, so that we can help the mothers.
Yeah.
And we want them to do their grieving.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was back in the time, this is 39 years ago now, so it's not.
We weren't supposed to show much emotion then, you know. It was. Ralph, would you like to make, before we get into a general discussion, would you like to make a comment?
I'd like to be a little negative.
Okay.
I've spent most of all my professional life in a hospital, and I don't know how I would react at the time, you know, within a week of my death. If I can tell my death a week ahead of time, I'm going to be doing a lot better than I could have been my patients. I'm not good, and I don't think many of my colleagues are good at being able to predict death. But anyway, the negative part is that I don't know that I would mind dying in a hospital. Now, it depends on what kind of a hospital it was, how they treated me, how the nurses were, if the nurses were well-trained, and, you know, all this kind of thing. But I like gadgets. I wouldn't mind being hooked up to all these gadgets that everybody are, you know. It isn't degrading to me, dehumanizing. You know, I feel great when I can have my a ham radio operator, and sort of related to having my rig out there. You know. So that's part of what I think we should think of. I think for most people, I would imagine that they would like to die at home, right next to their loved ones. You do have the support of the medical people, and that's also quite supportive to us now. We, in fact, we medical people suffer from the having given the impression that we can do too much. You know, we lose the last one. Everybody's going to die. And we've given the impression that we're magicians, and we aren't. And so it is comforting just to have a doctor right next to you. If you can have a doctor call on you when you need to, you know, all these kind of things, I think that would mean a lot as far as being at home. And I think it's great that we're thinking about this ahead of time. I'm sure maybe many of you are like me, I can't make up my mind which I'd like to have. But at least I've thought about it and thought about the different aspects of it. Another thing that has really impressed me is that I find suddenly that I have always thought I was immortal. I wasn't going to die. I knew I was going to die, but I didn't feel it until I got into my 60s, and then it becomes more and more real. No, it's there. It isn't, I look ahead, 20 years, if I live 20 years, that's going to be a miracle. Man, I had a coronary 4 years ago. Well, 20 years isn't very long anymore. And with this is our shortening of time. At age 60, time is maybe half of what it was even at 30. You know, when you're a kid waiting 2 days for Christmas, now it seems like death will be, you know, 2 days off, as in the same relationship to how we felt about it. And that's a perfectly normal development of our mind, is that time goes that much faster. So now I am going to die, and I'll have to start to think about it. And I do, I can't help it. That's part of my mental development, my maturity. And I wonder how many of you start to think of, well, I want to be buried in a dry place because I don't want all that wet seeping out. And you know, how silly can one be? Or I certainly wouldn't want to be cremated because, I mean, being in a fire? These kind of things that now I have to take into account. And I think it's great that I have to. Have any of you had that experience that now you are mortal? Now, every once in a while at least, you think, hey, I'm going to die, and you feel it. Sometimes it's scary.
I think that ministers nowadays prepare you for death as being a happy occasion. And I think it's more realistic that you can look forward to death. But the one thing that I would say, my son died on a machine 3.5 months, and I think that's the cruelest thing that could ever happen to anybody. If you're not going to get well, and to see them deteriorate, and he was only 42, and I tell you, that was absolutely terrible. And of course, as a mother, I don't know what I would do. I had nothing to say. He was married, you know. But I know of one other case, a mother-in-law. The family decided that she was to have no more chemotherapy. The doctor came, she said, what are you going to do for me? So you don't know whose hands it's in. But if you could make a choice ahead and prepare yourself, I think that living on a machine is the worst thing.
I've been in hospitals all my life, and my husband died in the hospital, and I was very glad that he was there. He had all of the attention that he needed. It was quick, but he did have the attention he needed. And the fact that my mind just goes blank when an emergency arises, I was glad that there was someone there with expertise that knew what to do and to support me.
Yeah, right.
And it was very beautiful the way it was. Incidentally, I have had left word that I'm on an Easter morning service.
What did you mean that you've been in hospitals all your life? Are you a...
I'm an occupational therapist.
Oh, okay. So you've really been...
I've worked in general hospitals all my life.
Okay. Yes?
Well, my husband lived 6 years, almost seven, after his heart literally exploded. And one thing I would say against the doctors is that as long as they let him have hope, he did fine. But when they told him it was absolutely hopeless, he deteriorated real fast. And he was able to be at home until the very end, and he asked, he said, "I don't feel very good. I think you better take me to the hospital." And for me, I would rather he died there. But I was a little upset with the hospital that they did not call me in the night and say that he was that bad. They, like she says, tried to put a pacemaker in him still at that late moment. And I think they put him through some extra pain that he didn't need.
You brought up a question that I think maybe we should talk about a little bit. Mm-hmm. That is the question of how much should we be told? I mean, you said that once he was told that his situation was hopeless, he went right downhill. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's one point of view, that maybe it isn't well to tell people. On the other hand, I think there are a lot of people who would like to know. If what their condition is realistically, so that they can prepare themselves and their family. So, does anyone have any comments you'd like to make about that?
I'd like to talk about that a little
more.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Because he knew that his time was near, but he didn't get that final. There's nothing we can do. Bang, at him. And in his later stages, I knew he knew that it wouldn't be long. But still, until somebody says it to you, is what I'm saying. I just don't think they needed to do that. And I had another friend who was the same way. As long as they didn't come out and say, tomorrow is the day, he was doing fine.
Anyone have any reaction to that at all? Yes.
I myself, or me, I haven't had any experience like that personally, but if it were me, I want to know what's going to happen. I want to be prepared. I've always asked, whenever I've been ill or had something in it, been in the hospital, I've always said, no, I don't know exactly. I don't want to hold anything back from me, and that's the way I feel, and I always have.
Okay. Well, yeah. Did someone over here?
My husband passed away 2 years ago of cancer. And in September of the year before he died, he had been diagnosed as cancer. And the doctor had our whole family in and talked to us and told us what our options were. He said, there's really no hope, but it is terminal. But he said, you can have chemotherapy if you want. It may help for a little while. So we left it up to my husband, and he says, well, it can't hurt me. So he did choose to have it.
Sure.
But he just had it until December, and he passed away in July. And he was home. I had him at home until about a week before he died, and he got an infection, and we had to send him to the hospital. But I was going to say, I'm really acquainted with death, because that 1 year, we lost four in our family, and 5 years ago, I lost a 31-year-old daughter. Mm-hmm. So you get a little acquainted with death, so I don't think I will mind dying. I will see all my loved ones.
Yeah. Okay.
Don't we all prepare for death? Don't we all prepare in our minds?
Do you think everybody prepares?
Yeah, don't you think that we have so much promise that we, in a way, look forward to death?
Are you asking me? Yes, surely we have the promise. Surely we do. But I'm not sure that that necessarily prepares us always for death. Maybe we should talk about that a little more. I was going to ask Ralph, who is a medical doctor, and how do doctors deal with the question that this lady raises over here of how much do you tell people and how realistic how do doctors deal with that question?
Well, oftentimes poorly. It's been interesting in my lifetime, it has completely reversed itself. At the beginning, back in the 40s, the greater part of the medical profession tended toward not telling. You know, none of this is black and white. In the last 15 years, there's been a great push to be absolutely honest. There's a difference, too, in between being honest and being brutal. Many of us are not that diplomatic, or all of us are never that diplomatic at all times. So that's one of the things you got to remember about your doctor. He's a human, like all the rest of us, and that he isn't going to do it perfectly each time. Another thing that I have seen with people who are terminal, and remember, we're all terminal. There's not one of us that isn't terminal, and we were terminal from birth, from before birth. When, we don't know. And when most physicians tell you about your conditions, they give you percentages. You have a good chance of living for so long. And that's all that we can say. We're human beings, we're a very complicated machine. And we should never try to make it better than that. Many of my friends are grandiose and say, well, you got a week. And then I hear these patients come back 30 years later and say that the doctor gave me 1 week, and they're so proud because they sure showed him. But there is the person, too, who will not accept the idea that death is coming. Just will not accept it. And you can tell it to him as much as you want to, and he won't hear you. And then we're all between those two points, I think. You need to know a certain amount. Because if you lie to anyone, and especially if they'll catch on to that you're lying. I mean, you tell him, oh, you're getting better, and he feels worse. You know, he won't trust you for anything. To be trustworthy, you've got to tell. And depending on the person, you may tell as much. You know, I would rather have somebody tell me that you're going to die on Wednesday. I'd rather have them say that than, well, you'll be hung by your neck till you're, what is the term they use, on such and such a time. We don't like to necessarily have all the gory details, and that isn't necessary. But we do like to be our own boss and plan our own life or our own death. I mean, plan as much as we can. And we aren't always ready to get the whole works either, and I think this is what you were saying, that, you know, the person wasn't ready to receive the idea that there was no hope. Well, there is, all you can say is that there's less hope. All of us have been acquainted with people who ought to have died and didn't. So you just can't cut off the last hope. You can say that, hey, this therapy is not going to do you any good. In my experience, this therapy will not do you any good. And that's all we can say. I tend to get emotional.
Yes. I think that's what I was trying to say, is the not to be brutal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And the other doctor who had talked to him before, he said, you should have your life in order. Mm-hmm. Well, that was an easier way of mm-hmm. putting it,
okay.
rather than saying, that's it, you know. But I would say about grieving afterwards, for me, because I had been with him for so long, and knowing him as a very active person, I would not have wanted him to be in bed for a long, long time. To me, it was a relief that he had his wish and did not have to be in bed. And for me, then I had a relief of, because every time I went away and came home, I said, what am I going to find? You know. So, but I did have him at home as much as I possibly could.
I suppose that all of us recognize in many instances, as she's saying, there's a twofold feeling. Mm-hmm. One is of relief and release, and the other one is of grief and loss, because the two go hand in hand, really, in many instances. And the fact that we may be able to accept and be relieved at someone's death, mm-hmm. at the same time, we still are left with a sense of loss and of grief and so on. We have to deal with that.
I think that's where one of our friends just died this summer, and he was so ready, and he called in all his friends, and we all said goodbye to him, and he was so ready, and he was just waiting to die, and he was just, but his wife then, of course, it was a little hard for her, because, you know, he was anxious to die. I mean, he was anxious, and she almost felt that, you know, that he was glad he could go. And she, we kind of had to minister to her almost at that point, because, and tell her that, you know, he just needs to die now, and you've been together so long, and he was 80, and he was ready to go. But Agnes was still, she still had a hard time, because she felt that he didn't want to be with her anymore.
Yeah, that was a really difficult thing to deal with, because she kind of resented his readiness to go, and felt really that this reflected something about his willingness to leave her. And so you get a whole lot of shadings of kinds of reactions to a person's death. Yes, did you want to say some more?
Yeah, I guess I'm talking too much.
Oh.
But nevertheless, I think the worst part has been for me is in friendships where there are couples, they exclude you.
That's an old widow's tale, you just forget it. Make your own life.
I know, but it hurts. That's what I'm trying to say.
But every widow goes through.
In other words, you're saying that change, that death changes the relationships.
Even the church, they said.
I see a lot of heads nodding here. Apparently, a lot of people must have.
And even in the church, they say, why don't you women, you widows, form a group? I said, I'm alone all the time. I want to be mixed company. You know, and, oh, I'm working on it.
Tell us the secret when you find out, will you?
Yes, this lady in the front row here.
I have something different to bring up. My younger sister took care of our mother, and she died at 98 years of age. And before she died, she made my sister promise to take care of our brother. He was single, and she didn't want him to have to live alone. Well, now, at the time, it wasn't too bad because he was able to take care of himself. Now he needs care. And she finally did promise my mother that she would. And now it's a burden to her. And she feels if she puts him in a home, then she's betraying my mother. And it's really getting to her mentally.
Mm-hmm.
So don't ever make your children promise something like that.
That must be a terrible burden to have it that is. Laid on you, and then not really be able to carry it out.
You feel guilty if you break it.
Yeah. Yes.
I feel as though that's a white lie. If that person's going to be happy and they're dying, how can somebody control you from beyond the grave for 40 or 50 years? I'd say, yes, mother, I will take care of them, and I would until the time changed, and then when it was necessary to do something else, and I'd certainly tell my sister that. And that's the only way you can keep going, is to be making decisions and not live in the past.
You can't tell them that.
You can tell them. Someday she'll listen. Sometimes you'll have to tell them.
Do you think you can tell? How do you think that should be handled?
Well, I know as a psychiatrist, I never tell anybody anything of what they're going to do. In the first place, they don't do it. I wouldn't do it, I know, if I were on that end. And the second place is that would solve only that particular instance, and the next day you're going to have another one. If the person I am working with, if he can make the decision himself, then he will be prepared to work on the next one. So I can't tell them what to do in this particular. I'm not in their skin, so I can't tell them what they should do. I can give illustrations of what has happened, and I can say, hey, the factors that you have said to me seem to be like so and so. Does that look like it? And they can say, no, it sure doesn't. That's the usual response. But they may think about it afterwards and then make their own decision. When you make your own decision, you're going to follow it a lot better than if somebody makes it for you.
But at the same time, if your sister puts him in a home, she's taking care of
him.
Yeah,
that's. I was going to make that point too. That what does taking care of mean? Does it mean you personally have to be there, or does it mean making arrangements for the best possible kind of situation? I think you have to relieve your sister of her feelings about that somehow. That taking care of doesn't necessarily mean that she personally puts her hands on him and takes care of. Could be hospitalization,
and
could be
nursing. And it might be better, too. I mean, it might be better for him to be in care.
I think I saw a hand back there.
Speaking of decisions and having people telling you what to do, one of our neighbors' husband is 52 and he was diagnosed as having a brain tumor. And within 5 months, he's gone downhill very quickly. He was getting these severe pains in his head. And we live in Minneapolis where they just did this brain surgery with the laser beam and the patient was awake. They had done a biopsy so they knew what type of cancer it was, where it was, the tumor, I mean, which was cancer. And so the doctors told her that this was his only chance. And she had to choose between whether supposedly letting him die or do this surgery. And it was sad, the surgery killed a lot of the good tissue, so he has to be put in a nursing home.
No, there are a lot of difficult decisions.
Very
I'd like to pick up on something that this lady, who said she spent a good deal of her life in hospitals, said that I think maybe we could talk about here a little bit to our profit. She raised the question, aren't we all prepared? And I think, as I listened to what she was saying, that by prepared, she means, you mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, and you say it if I'm not saying it right, that of being at peace with the idea of our death. Is that what you mean by prepared?
I think that I should live every day, live it up, and when the time comes, I think that's my time, and I'm ready.
Yeah. All right, let me make a confession. I have worked at being prepared for death. I've thought about it a great deal. Kroll and I have talked about it, and as these friends of ours have died, we have tried to work it through and so on. And I would like to make a witness that I am a confessing Christian who believes wholeheartedly that Jesus is my Savior, that Jesus rose from the dead, and that He has promised me that I will be with Him. I believe that wholeheartedly. Now the confession. I'm still anxious. When I think about dying, I get butterflies in my stomach, or I get frightened. Even though I believe wholeheartedly in the resurrection and everlasting life, I don't quite, you know, when you say, aren't we all prepared, I guess I'm prepared in one way, but in another way, I'm fearful.
It's such a mystery.
Does anybody have a similar experience, Rosemary?
I just feel like the whole thing is such a mystery. We don't know. You know, we don't know for sure. And a lot of poets have written poetry about, you know, stepping over the threshold and making it sound like it's just like walking through the door or going down a tunnel or, but we don't know. I guess to me,
my wife's got a hand up on poetry. She's on that. On
okay.
That. You don't need to help me out.
She knows that. I don't know, I open my mouth too much.
You haven't said a thing all day.
I talk too much. I talk too much. But I wanted to share with all of you the reason that I'd lost my fear of death. And it was because of the beautiful death that my father had. He had a series of strokes and was supposedly in a coma. He was not in a deep coma because he whispered my name when I spoke to him. Nobody else was even trying to speak to him, and I knew he was still with us, so I spoke to him and he whispered my name. I wasn't there when he actually passed away, but I heard from my mother and my brother that he who was supposedly in a coma before some of his strokes had taken away his ability to speak clearly, he came out of his coma, spoke very clearly about this beautiful vision or picture that he was seeing in the sky, and he described it to the family. I had a dream or whatever some years before that in which I saw something that I think he saw when he was dying. I don't know if it was the same picture that he saw, but I feel that whatever is on the other side is so wonderful and so beautiful, so glorious, that we just can't comprehend it. It is a mystery. But it must be the most wonderful thing to be able to have that mystery gone and really experience death. And I'm not looking forward to death, but I'm not afraid of death.
Okay, all right. Now, I've said, you know, that I feel a little anxious when I think about that. She approaches it with real equanimity and. Yeah.
Both of us have lost our first spouses here, and I saw my wife get sick in 68 with cancer, and it was a gradual process over 2.5 years, more than 2.5 years. at first it hits you like a rock in the head, you know, wow, she's got cancer, what's going to happen now? But after you see all the processes that you went through, the doctors tried all kinds of different operations, she had everything that she was taken out, I guess taken out, and all kinds of chemotherapy and everything else, and by the time the end came, you were prepared, you knew that she wasn't going to get well, there was no hope, and so you just accepted that this is the way it's going to be.
Very good. All right. That's a progression type of thing. Mm-hmm. What does that do for you now when you contemplate your own demise?
Well, I haven't really thought too much about it.
You haven't thought about it. Well, I get a little butterflies when I think about that. Yeah, I think I saw a hand over here. Yes.
Yeah, just along the line of preparation, we haven't mentioned wills. I think this is something that should be looked at and brought
okay.
up to date. Because I see more pain and strain happening at death because of wills which aren't updated, and take a look at your life insurance policies. And I think you can go ahead and prepare for your death by seeing your pastor and indicate, or in writing also that will, indicate what kind of a funeral you want. There's much preparation along these lines can be done. But we all delay, so to speak, especially on that will thing.
Yeah, we're going to have a little session tonight. The forum is going to deal with that question of when do you, how do you control death, and how, you know, the big question that comes to everybody nowadays is when you've got so much machinery. Ralph said that he didn't mind the machinery. Other people, you know, have real strong feelings about being life being prolonged. We're going to try to deal with that tonight. When do we pull the plug? You know, that's going to be the subject tonight, and we're going to talk a little bit about living wills and so on. Let's try to deal a little bit more with this, the question that has been raised here about, as we look at our own possible leaving of this world, as over against our Christian faith. Is it wrong to feel anxious? Is it wrong to be somewhat fearful?
Well, I had heard someone say once that that the fetus is very comfortable, knows just what everything is easy, and that birth is pretty traumatic, and probably if it had a decision, it would stay in that place where he's comfortable and warm. But when he is born, then he comes into life as we know it. And it's a pretty nice thing. And so perhaps that's what this life is. We want to stay here. We're comfortable. We understand it, and we've accepted the things that we have to accept. And perhaps we aren't going to choose to go into this next world. But perhaps we can think, well, maybe it'll be a lot better, more than things that we can't even imagine that will be like. It'll be like the difference between where the baby was and when he was born.
Okay, Rob?
Let me hog it. I'm up in front. I get to hog a little bit. I think it's perfectly physiological that we do fear death or don't like death. I mean, after all, if we did like death, you know, we wouldn't be here today. So I think it's perfectly physiological, but I think it's also physiological to think about it and make our decisions. And my own experience is that sometimes I am very much withdrawn from the world, disengaged, I guess is the best way, because withdrawn is a bad word, and you aren't supposed to do that. But disengaged. And I can really honestly feel, hey, it's great to get out of the rat race. And then maybe more of the time, I feel exactly like Paul is saying, hey, you know, I don't know what's coming. I don't know how it's going to be. It's part of my physiological drive to live and not to die. And that's there. And I go from one to the other. Maybe the rest of you are much more stable, but that's the way I get it.
I always feel too, you know, like Paul, I hate to miss out on something that's happening. If I should go, then maybe Paul would have lots of fun with somebody else.
I'm not saying a word. This is the point at which a husband should keep his mouth shut.
I think that I was prepared for my wife's death because I was with her all the time to see her deteriorating and knew it was coming. But it really hit my three children pretty hard.
Yeah.
And they were college age. In fact, my son was in the Army. Got home just the day before she died, just on her birthday. But my youngest daughter was in college, and then she wrote her master's degree on in social work on death and dying. That was her subject of her master's work.
Yeah, well,
I have
this lady here.
Just a comment, our granddaughter, when she was about 5 or 6 years old, she said, "I'm not afraid of dying," but she said, "What I'm afraid of is what's going to happen just before."
Okay. I like to look at it kind of in two parts. I think Corolla said something important here, and that is, I love life. No question about it. And I'm reluctant to let it go. At the same time, I believe wholeheartedly that I'm going to live with the Lord forever.